Well, this is Peter Ford. I had a long career in the Foreign Office. I was ambassador in Bahrain, and then my final posting was in Damascus. I was there from 2003 until 2006, and then I had a second career with the United Nations, as it happens, with the agency for Palestinian refugees, raising money for Gaza, would you believe?
Well, yes, I would. Can you just tell us a little bit about the Foreign Office and the diplomatic service? Because I think for many of us, this is, you know, these are ivory towers. And it's also the fact that you've got institutions like Chatham House, who are kind of private versions of foreign policy think tanks that are often loaded. I mean, you know, that their budgets can be enormous compared to even to the Foreign Office. So can you say something about, you know, the Foreign Office, how they operate?
Well, just to dispose of Chatham House quickly, and I wish we could dispose of Chatham House quickly. They are the sort of in-house think tank for the Foreign Office. They pretend to be independent, but of course they just feed what they think will serve the Foreign Office different agenda. It wasn't always like that, but in the last couple of decades they've become totally subservient. The Foreign Office itself has changed for the worse. I watch from a distance, but I can see that a loss of expertise, fewer Arabic speakers. They make a deliberate point now of sending ambassadors to Arab countries who don't speak Arabic. There's a willful ignorance and blindness about the Foreign Office these days. Very few of the heads of mission are now properly qualified.
Just tell us a bit about that relationship between Chatham House and the Foreign Office. Who's wearing the trousers?
Well, it's all about money, of course, Tony. Money and careers. Sometimes Foreign Office personnel do secondments with Chatham House, or they go there after their careers in the Foreign Office, revolving door. But I think I'm correct in saying that one way or another, Chatham House gets most of its funding from the British government, and the Foreign Office are the people who call the shots on that allocation of funding. And it's much the same with other so-called think tanks, I've forgotten their name, the Royal College of Defence Studies is another. And wherever you look,
this RUSI is another one that often pops up in times of crisis. You quite often see a representative of RUSI, Royal United Services Institute, as well, popping up on there. And I always recommend people to go to Professor David Miller's site, the site that he set up, SpinWatch and SourceWatch, where you can actually look at the individual, when an expert pops up on TV, who is funding them. And what bothers me, it's often private companies that are funding these people, Peter.
Yes, that too. But the most pernicious and by far the greatest funding is from government. There are different cutouts, and some of it's disguised, but it all goes back to the Foreign Office and the security agencies.
Can you tell us a bit about Syria? Because I think for most people, it's the last place they would think at the moment of going on holiday. And yet, actually, although there are sporadic attacks normally by the Israelis at the moment, it is an amazing, wonderful and unique country, Damascus, an incredibly historic city. So can you just tell us a bit about the character of the people and the place?
Yes, Syria is a wonderful country with thousands of years of history. It was the cradle of civilization, fantastic ruins there, The people are really the nicest. I visited all the Arab countries, and the Syrians are the nicest, the most friendly, and most cultivated people. Many of them are eccentric. it's a charming people and a charming country, and what's been practiced on it over the last 15 years is appalling, particularly now that Syria is under the cosh of Western sanctions, which are just another form of atrocity. It's more subtle than beating people over the head or with bombs, but the results are just as devastating.
So that anyone wants to know a bit about the Syrian civil war, well, you could call it a civil war. It seems that there was some definite outside involvement as well. This started just after the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi, and many of the fighters that went over to Syria to try and topple Assad or actually had come from Libya. Can you just give us in a nutshell? I know it's a bit of a big ask, but for those that have been just befuddled by a lot of the coverage about what happened in Syria and the Syrian civil war, the attempts to throw Assad, we were getting told on Channel 4 yeah. News all the time by Matt Fry, oh, Damascus is about to fall, Assad is about to be toppled. Of course, he's still there. So what was it all about?
Yes, well first you have to forget everything you thought you already knew about the Syrian conflict and start again. I'll keep it simple. The conflict was essentially on one side, the secular, not religious government of Syria, composed of a mosaic of communities, the different Muslim sects, Christians, Druze, Armenians, Turks. And on the other side, Sunni fundamentalists, and I stress Sunni because there were no Shia, the other big sect of Islam. Sunni fundamentalists, similar to ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they were all Sunnis to a man and a woman, allied with the Western backers and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and other rich Arab countries. And the conflict could be described as the war for Sunni ascendancy in Syria. The Sunni jihadis with their Sunni Gulf Arab backers were aiming at some form of caliphate in Syria, which would be a client of America and Europe. That, in a nutshell, is what it was all about. It was not about democracy, because the last thing the Sunni fundamentalists, the jihadis, wanted was democracy. No, it was about they didn't like other people having hands on the levers of power, particularly people from the Shia sect, and the Assad family came from one branch of the Shia called the Alawites. They could not stand other people being in control of Syria.
So we've seen various other countries falling, not least of which was this, the one I mentioned, Libya. How come the Syrians, how come Assad is still there?
Yes, indeed. I remember one of my successors as ambassador predicting in, I think, 2012, was it, that Assad would be gone by Christmas. Well, he didn't actually say Christmas of which year, so he could still be proven right. But that is typical of the hubris, the arrogance, and the sheer stupidity of the people in charge of our foreign policy. They take their wishes for reality, and we see that to this very day. perhaps we can come on to that, the wishful thinking, which is the abiding sin of the Foreign Office. So the Syrian conflict, I predicted, you didn't have to be smart to get this right, that Assad would be virtually impossible to overthrow because he does enjoy solid support from a majority of the people, and he's in control of the institutions, in particular the army, which is mixed in terms of the communities represented in the army, and that includes probably a majority of Sunni soldiers, not seduced by Sunni fundamentalism. So it should not have been a surprise. And the only thing that kept the conflict going was constant interference from outside. You'll recall that the Western powers bombed Syria when the Fancy took them under the pretext of alleged use of chemical weapons. And for the last few years, the baton has been taken up by Turkey, which effectively occupies the northernmost province of Syria, while the Americans effectively occupy the province next door, which just happens to be the one which has all the oil.
Yeah, but there's also the matter of the Russians appearing over everyone's heads, and the fact that they, I think, is it called Tarsus, they have a naval base in Syria. This, you know, they obviously do believe that it's important that they're able to project power not just into the Black Sea but into the Eastern Mediterranean too. So they had they most definitely had skin in the fight, didn't they?
I wouldn't phrase it like that. That's a very Western, and particularly American and British idea that you have to project power. That is everything that is wrong with the Western system, that you have to project power. In other words, boss the rest of the world around. I don't think that's the way the Russians think. They think more defensively. They're unhappy to see a country not very far from their own borders becoming an American satellite. I think their moves in Syria to support the government, and by the way, they only came in heavily when Damascus was literally under siege by ISIS, which had been backed by our side, was on the point of taking control of Damascus. They were literally at the gates, 5 miles away from downtown Damascus. It was only at that point that Russia came in massively and helped to turn the tide. Iran had been helping Syria from the get-go, but they didn't have the means that the Russians had. Now, it's true that historically the Russians had considered Syria as a friendly country and had previously in the time of, in the 60s and 70s, had been very close to Syria. Syria was a socialist country. Their system was not too dissimilar from Soviet communism. So they had a lot in common. But then there was something of an estrangement when I arrived in Damascus. It was a month after Bashar al-Assad had sat in Buckingham Palace having tea with the Queen. That was in, I think, 2003. That was a moment when the West thought that Assad might be brought over to the Western side. People don't like to remember that, I'm living proof. And I saw how little prestige the Russian ambassador had at that time in Damascus. I had better access to the leadership than he did. And we threw that away. in the course of pursuing the Iraq war, which spooked Syria. They could see that the Westerners who'd been courting them were now plotting their downfall. The Americans said openly, after Baghdad, it's Damascus and Tehran. So naturally, they did their best to make life difficult for the Western powers in Iraq. And our relations went downhill from that point.
Well, I'm reminded of Tony Blair going to visit Gaddafi just before the coup against him and the overthrow of Gaddafi. I think, you know, that's one of the almost the symbols of you need to get worried if a British prime minister comes and says hello and starts smiling and wants to have his photograph taken with you. But anyway, last week we had a most horrific attack in Syria, which was a graduation ceremony in a military college where over 100 people were killed by a drone or by drones. I mean, this really was... It was briefly in the news for a day, and then the news agenda was completely swamped by Hamas's attacks in Israel. So could you say something about this attack last week? Because when I saw what had happened, I was really shocked. This was a deliberate attempt to neuter Syria's ability to defend itself or to fight into many decades to come. I mean, all these young men at this academy were the future of Syria's military, and to turn up at their graduation ceremony, I mean, surely whoever's done this, he's declaring war on the country.
The guilty parties were one of the jihadi groups that remain ensconced in the northern province, which is controlled by Turkey. And the group is actually, believe it or not, Chinese Muslims, the Uyghur that we're always defending and accusing China of genociding. Well, they have their Islamist extremists that they've largely managed to kick out, and many of them fled to Syria, where they're paid by Turkey to make life difficult for Syria, the Syrian government.
Well, of course, Turkey is NATO, really, isn't it?
Exactly. But Turkey has its own fish to fry with regard to Syria. They historically, Syria was part of the Ottoman Empire, and I think in the Turkish mind, it still is. So they're not the Turks actually following the NATO agenda as such. They're not happy to see the Americans in control of the neighboring province because the Americans are using the Kurds there. The Kurdish militia are a proxy force for the Americans. So the Turks are by no means allies of the Americans in Syria. And just in the last week, there have been clashes involving military aircraft of the Turks and I believe the Americans. No, the Turks have their own reasons for wanting to destabilize Syria, and it comes down largely to religion. The Turks are Sunni, or the ruling clique in Turkey are also Islamist fanatics, with much in common with the jihadis. The Turks provided the drones, which were then used by these Uyghur militias to inflict this horrible damage, as you say, on a generation of qualifying military cadets. But in strategic terms, it's not very important. It's been a terrible blow for the Syrians' pride, and possibly the morale of the armed forces, but it doesn't alter the price of potatoes. The strategic position is just the same. It doesn't bring any nearer the removal of the what they like to call the Assad regime. It shows that the Uyghur are important players. It shows that the Turks still have a capability to disrupt things in Syria. And that's about it.
The Uyghurs manufacturing their own drones, are you saying these are built built by the Turks or bought by the Turks? Because obviously when it comes to things like targeting, I would be surprised if the Uyghurs had the satellites, etc., to do that kind of thing.
Exactly. It's virtually certain that the Turks are actually quite good at manufacturing drones. These are much wanted pieces of kit being used, I believe, by the Ukrainians and as well as by the Turks themselves. The Turks will certainly have provided some assistance, although the military college is not a moving target. It would have been technically relatively easy to hit the college.
Moving on to the next day, what do you make of these moves over in Gaza and Palestine? I mean, it's been particularly bloody. The death toll now is coming up to around about 2,500, we believe, Israelis and Hamas. There's several things to note about this. One is that the Egyptians claim to have warned Israel 10 days before this happened that there was Hamas were planning some sort of an incursion. And yet there doesn't seem to have been any awareness or resistance that last Saturday morning to these fighters getting through into Israel. Also, Hamas, as the Times of Israel has reported on several occasions, was basically a creation of the Israelis in order to stymie the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, and Yasser Arafat. So, you know, there are all sorts of questions about the legitimacy of this, and particularly the rather horrific decision of the Israeli government to stop supplying water, stop supplying food, stop supplying electricity to Gaza.
Well, sometimes, Tony, things are what they seem. What's happened here, very simply, is that Hamas were very skillful at deceiving the Israelis. The Israelis are not as clever as people think, especially themselves. They've become arrogant after long years of not having to fight any serious enemy, and complacent. So they probably dismissed this Egyptian warning. There have probably been other false alarms before. I mean, this is probably one of the techniques that Hamas has used. They've done feints, pretend attacks, which would then, of course, discredit what they would have told the Egyptians, who would have told the Israelis. And so this time the Israelis said, I'm no doubt, oh, not again. Only it was for real this time. Hamas was preparing this operation for 2 years. 2 years. And now the Israelis will not have had even 2 weeks before they launch their ground operation, if that's what it is. And I think it will not be a walkover. If indeed they do enter Gaza, they will have a very hot welcome and may live to regret it. I'm not, although it's odds on that they will invade Gaza, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. And this is partly because Hamas must have calculated that the Israelis were going to invade, and therefore this is part of the plan. This was possibly a deliberate attempt to lure Israel, to draw it into kind of ambush. And I'm not surprised that the Israelis are indulging in displacement activity at the moment, like bombing the airport of Damascus and the airport of Aleppo, which they've done today. I read this as displacement activity to disguise the fact that they are hesitant. They may yet bottle it. They may yet let themselves be persuaded by the Americans not to do it. Or they may persuade themselves that they have to put the lives of the hostages first. By the time this program goes out, I may be proven wrong, but I'm just saying it's not a foregone conclusion that the Israelis will go into Gaza, and that if they do, they will have an easy time of it.
One of the former senior political figures in, I'm not quite sure who it was, you can maybe tell me, yesterday was saying that they think Netanyahu's actually the worst person to defend Israel in this sort of situation. I mean, he's facing criminal charges. He's trying to get the constitution changed so that the Supreme Court cannot prosecute him. And we've had all these demonstrations going on every weekend since the beginning of 2023 in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, etc., in Israel, where they're holding up these signs saying crime minister. So what do you think about Netanyahu, whether he can actually command the respect of the Israeli military, the Israeli judiciary, and the Israeli people?
Netanyahu is dead man walking. He's dead man walking because he has failed. He brought this tragedy onto the Israeli people, and it will catch up with him. He was already in trouble, as you pointed out, and this is just the final and most important nail in his coffin. Of course, they can't get rid of him in the midst of the crisis, but when the dust settles, I'm sure that he will fall. When the Israelis have had previous tragedies and mistakes and crises, they always have a big commission. So there's a commission after the 73 war. There was a commission after the failed 2006 war with Hezbollah. The end of it always involves some head honchos, heads rolling. Well, Netanyahu's will be on the plate. I'm fairly sure of that. There's not much he can do, actually. If he attacks Gaza and then they get a lot of casualties, he's toast. And if they don't attack Gaza after he's marched them all to the top of the hill, well, he's also toast. No wonder he is frantic. Actually, despite all the dreadful suffering in Gaza, and there may be a lot worse to come, and although Hamas may lose the coming battle, but I believe that Hamas have already won the war. Now, why do I say that? Well, look at the results. The Palestine issue has re-emerged as the top global issue that needs addressing. Ukraine, remind me, where's Ukraine? What's that about? Palestine was being forgotten, and the Hamas, at a stroke, have managed to make more ground than the Palestine Authority made in 20 years. So that everybody is now saying that this problem must be solved once and for all. I think the best conceivable outcome from all this is that when the Israelis have their commission and their inquest and possibly their soul searching, something better will emerge on their side. And they may even ask themselves whether they didn't bring the tragedy on their own heads, and that what they need to do is make peace with their enemies. You only make peace with your enemies, not with your friends, like the meek and mild Arab countries who have been making peace. They never actually fought, most of them, Israel. So it's a strange peace that they've been making. No, Israel may draw, I hope, the conclusion that you make peace with your enemies, not with your friends.
I'm reminded a little bit, you know, you saying there about the way that suddenly the Ukraine war has been sort of hoofed off the news agenda in a week by this conflict in Palestine, very much like the whole COVID discussion, which had been going on for years, was hoofed off the headlines by Ukraine back in February 2022. But look, with I come back to Netanyahu, you know, if he plays his cards right, like I'm thinking about Margaret Thatcher and the Falklands here, you know, it is possible for political leaders to actually get a lot of political capital out of conflicts like this.
No, I don't think so. And however it pans out, it's going to be very dirty and very messy. The best scenario that Netanyahu could realistically envisage is one where, after bitter fighting, the Israelis emerge as in control of Gaza. But what are they going to do then? What are they going to do then? They were forced to leave already 16 years ago. They didn't leave Gaza because they're such good people and they wanted to be nice. They left because they were afraid. They were afraid of Hamas. They were being harassed. They were losing soldiers. So they cannot stay in Gaza. No, whatever the outcome, it's not good for Netanyahu. And I haven't even gone into the international ramifications, because although at the moment the Western world is intoxicated with their new love affair for Israel, but they will soon sober up. This process is already perhaps beginning with the stories of suffering. We're beginning to hear suffering on the part of the Palestinians this time. I think Netanyahu is toast.
Whereabouts do you think this is going? I mean, you've already hinted, this is a unprecedented situation, as far as I understand, for no water, no food, etc., for nearly 2 million people in Gaza. The ultimatum issued by Netanyahu is that all of the hostages which Hamas has taken have to be released before any of the people in Gaza. Now, it does seem that it's almost designed to force anyone that is a pacifist Palestinian to become militant, because unless they do, they're liable to die of thirst or starve. And I don't quite know if anyone in Israel has really thought this through, or maybe they have. Maybe this is a form of, you know, a collective punishment, the sort of thing that we used to see from the Nazis.
Well, Tony, the former head of SIS said, or it was reported yesterday, that he thought that the worst thing Israel could do from its own point of view was to invade Gaza. Not only would they be walking into a trap, a well-prepared trap by Hamas, but they would also be putting Western governments, I use his words, into an impossible position. Now, what he meant by that was that Western governments would have to withdraw their support when the harrowing images emerged of Palestinians dying of hunger and thirst. I mean, even I, who am prepared to believe the absolute worst of our leaders, believe that they would be forced, they would be put in an impossible position to go on supporting Israel. And at that point, Israel would have to stop.
Yeah, so the chap you're talking about, XMI6 chief Tom Porter, he's saying, you know, he's saying pretty much what you're saying, that there's a trap here, and if the Israelis go in, that is a trap. The alternative is unthinkable. The idea of up to 2 million people being starved to death.
Indeed, it may be what the Israelis initially planned. But now, as the days tick by, I think it's increasingly coming to be seen that that is not practical. And you also have now the international rescue squad on the way. I don't mean the American and now British warships. I mean the serious diplomats. And again, I'm not talking about James Cleverly, obviously. I'm talking about Antony Blinken, who quite cleverly has programmed a series of lightning visits to Arab capitals, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Egypt. All this will impose restraint on Israel. They will not attack without the American green light. And while the Americans are trying to conduct diplomacy, I very much doubt the Israelis would defy them.
The British response has been to send ships and aircraft to support Israel. I don't quite see how ships and aircraft are going to help at all in this situation. So why are they doing that, deploying aircraft and ships to support Israel? A ship, how is that going to help the Israelis in any way? And when I saw that British aircraft were flying over to Israel, I was thinking to myself, what are they going to do? Are they going to be dropping food into Gaza? Are they going to be dropping water supplies somehow into these beleaguered people in this massive prison camp? But no, apparently they're there to just get people out of Israel. And there's a lot of points in this rather convoluted question, Peter. I'm sorry about that. But also, you know, we've got the situation there where, are they really trying to get people out of this situation? Because there must be many Jews over the decades who've come to Israel now thinking, what am I doing here? Maybe I'd better get out.
It's madness. It's reckless madness. By sending warships and saying that we're sending them in support of Israel, we are, in law, international law, making ourselves what they call a co-belligerent. Co-belligerent. Now, this seems fantastic, except that when you're a co-belligerent, it gives the other side the legal right to hit you. So we're making ourselves targets for any party, whether it's at the moment Hamas, maybe tomorrow Hezbollah, maybe Iran, to hit us. And it would be perfectly legal because we are co-belligerents with Israel. You know,
I mean, it does seem to me that, you know, by sending warships, the obvious thing that they're doing is they're saying, well, actually, we don't believe it. This is really just Hamas doing this, you know, with some guys with guns, that actually there are big states involved and we might sink their ships.
Well, I'd point out that not just we're making ourselves co-belligerents in the legal sense, but we're also saying to any potential terrorists, come and hit us. We stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel. If you hit us, it will be just as good as hitting Israel. I tell you, Tony, I am advising my own family not to go to big shopping centers that might be targets for terrorists at the moment. Not particularly, don't stand near plate glass, because that's how you're most likely to get hurt. I mean, this is serious. This is serious. We are more or less inviting ISIS, come and hit us, do your worst. We love Israel. That's more important than British lives.
Yeah, this whole idea of what is a terrorist has been interesting. The BBC have been criticised for refusing to call Hamas a terrorist organisation.
Well, this is silly. This is just silly playing with words. And I never myself used the word terror or terrorist because it's meaningless. Terror is a technique of warfare. And terrorist is just an adjective used to score political points. It doesn't actually mean anything. It's just people we don't like who use violence against civilians. But Israel has used violence against civilians on a daily basis for decades. Are they also, can we call them terrorists? It's meaningless. It's better not to call anybody terrorists.
Yes, but one of the latest terrorist groups is the Palestinian human rights documenters. I can't remember the exact name of them, but there's a group in Palestine that have been taking notes of all the various violations of human rights, sending it up to the UN and working very closely with the UN Human Rights Commission on all this, and they have now been designated a terrorist group too.
Oh, that's news to me, but nothing surprises in the feverish atmosphere of the moment. I'm afraid when I go on a protest next week in London, I may well get arrested simply for protesting.
So that means you're a terrorist too?
Hopefully not that bad.
They're talking in the UK, aren't they, about, Suella Braverman is saying that flying the Palestinian flag could be considered a criminal offence here in Britain. I mean, it may be just scare tactics, but quite clearly we are taking sides with the very powerful side against the Palestinians. And it is almost as if we've learnt nothing from the decades of Islamophobia.
It's ramping up Islamophobia, while on the one hand, we say that we're protecting one community, the Jewish community. We're stirring up hatred on the part of the Islamic community and hatred against the Muslims in this country. The Muslims are now the only people in this country against whom you can express hate speech and people applaud. And you don't get taken to court. Watching stations that I used to admire, like GB News, you won't agree with me. You'll say my admiration was ill-placed, and you may well be right. But watching them, reading the Daily Mail, the language is appalling. It's fascistic. It's definitely racist.
Yeah, the human rights groups that Israel has designated terrorist groups are Al-Haq, that's Al-HAQ, a human rights group founded in 1979. ADAMER, which is ADAMER, Defence for Children International, Palestine. The Bissan Centre for Research and Development, the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, and the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. Now, I suppose we're expected to believe that these are all just terrorist fronts and that these people who are going out with clipboards saying, oh gosh, you've just shot somebody there, and taking photographs, recording the dates and the times, maybe, collecting evidence, that they're actually maybe secretly trying to infiltrate and they've got guns. Now, there is an element of mental illness here. It seems like a form of, schizophrenic paranoia almost.
And it's lunacy. It's wicked. We've lost all sense of reality and ethics, and what we thought made us British, respect for other people's opinion, freedom of speech, all that's gone out of the window. And this is partly because there is no peace party now in this country. In days gone by, the Labour Party and maybe the Liberals too would have been a bulwark against this, even if they were in opposition, or they would at least have acted as a break. But the brakes are off now. There are no brakes on the British state in its fit of madness here. The brakes are off. The train is careening down the rails with no brakes. In fact, the Labour are even worse, more irresponsible than the Tories, because they feel they have to do down their past, their Corbynite past. So there's no balance now in the British political system, and there'll be a heavy price to pay. I wonder if these politicians will apologize to the families of those victims to come at the hand of some lone wolf terrorist, which it's only too easy to predict will, within the next month, be striking a British target.
So we're facing this prospect. We've had something like 1,000 Israelis so far after a week have been killed. A roughly similar number, maybe 1,500 Palestinians. But then there is this, there are 2 million in Gaza who could potentially be starved here. Who is going to come to their aid? Who is going to be, you know, doing the heroic job of getting water and getting food in there? Is anyone?
Well, the United Nations, or the agency I used to work for myself, has a big presence there. They run the schools and most of the hospitals in Gaza, and they also have a food supply operation. So they are the most obvious people, but they need to get it in. I understand that talks are underway involving the Egyptians on how physically, practically to make this happen. And I'm hopeful that it will be made to happen in the coming days, because it will be putting Western governments in an impossible position if the Israelis seriously try to maintain a blockade. It is just not tenable. Already, the UN Secretary General, even the EU are saying it would be against international law. The game is up. The game is up. The Israelis can huff and puff and bluster. They're very good at that. But the game is up. They either now have to bite the bullet and go and risk their soldiers' lives marching into Gaza, or they have to pack up and go home.
Well, or maybe negotiate over these hostages, because it seems to me that's one of the major purposes of Hamas's operation, is actually to force. I mean, it's a little bit like the US refusal to negotiate with Russia and Ukraine's refusal. You know, there has to be some sort of negotiation for there ever to be peace, and the Israelis have completely refused to do that, and so maybe this will force their hand.
Indeed, and it's possible to imagine a scenario where Hamas do bargain the hostages against an Israeli undertaking not to invade. But who would believe? Who would believe the Israelis weren't going to invade once they'd
got their hands? Well, you may see a prisoner swap or something like that, and or at least there may be another player, like, for example, the Russians, Chinese, or whatever involved in trying to guarantee an agreement.
No, they'll be kept out by the Americans. No, that's not going to happen. Although I agree, it would be eminently sensible, but it's not going to happen. That's the last thing the Americans want. No, it's a conundrum. It's a real conundrum, and you need an expert in game theory to work this out. What to do with hostages if once you've given them up? You've lost your bargaining cards. On the other hand, if you don't give them up, you're going to get attacked. Since Hamas are not afraid of being attacked, I think they will hold the hostages till the end.
Okay, Peter Ford, former ambassador to Syria and also Bahrain, and a bit of an expert on the Middle East. It's great. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good questions, Tony. Good discussion. Thank you.